as many of you know, in these talks, I try and focus it on real events or things which aren't theoretical but practical in your life. And the topic which has come up for me this evening on a few experiences over the last week or 2 weeks. I know that sometimes people have called me or have had to talk with them, because you know, life can be sometimes quite depressing. Things don't really go the way they should. Or there's problems in your life, and people keep asking me, what's the purpose of all this? And what the heck is this life all about? Can you please give me sort of some great overview, the big plan, so I know what the heck I'm doing this for and why these things happen to me? So this evening I'm going to talk about the very simple subject of the meaning of life. Or rather than that, because even that subject is like becomes theoretical. It becomes like some sort of idea. And so that is not going to be the slant which I'm going to give to this talk. The slant I'm going to give is not finding the meaning of life, but putting the meaning into your life. It's a totally different idea. The meaning of life is describing you some theory, some religious view or spiritual view, just to telling you what to believe or how to look at life. But no, I'm telling you how you put meaning into your life. Because if you don't put meaning into your life, you'll find that life does become quite meaningless. And you know, you just wonder what it's all about, what you're doing this for. There's nothing which really can give you any drive, any passion in your life. And I say this as a monk because I'm a very passionate monk. A compassionate one, at least. But you know that I really put a lot of energy into whatever I do. And you know, that is, for me, what passion is. Because you understand that how to put something really important into your life, some meaning into your life. And I found out that most people in this life who do get depressed, who do sort of get negative, it is because they haven't learned how to put meaning, the real meaning, the proper meaning into life. Yeah, sure that people actually put a lot of energy and struggle in their life just to getting on in this world, to succeed. And the trouble is that we don't know really what success is. When you're a kid, you're at school, you think success is getting your grades at school or in exams or whatever. And look, I mean, that you should all know by now, because how many of you did really well at school? But you can still be happy and find meaning in life. Otherwise, if you really have to just to be, you know, the A-grade student, if they're the only ones who have meaning in life, you might as well commit suicide after grade 12 if you don't get to university, which is a stupid idea. But you know, you find out that that is not real meaning in life. So you find out, most people, they find out that they try it and they assume that other people know what the meaning of life is, and they just follow other people like sheep. And because they follow other people like sheep, yeah, you do work hard at school because that's what, you know, your parents and teachers tell you to do. And think, if I do this right, you know, then I'll find some meaning and I can find happiness. And then afterwards you go to work and you know, think you can find meaning in just your bank balance, or you know, your possessions or whatever else which you start to attain in life. And then you start questioning that. You know, that doesn't really give you what everyone promised you. Certainly that was my life. You know, going to school, I did really well. I did work hard. So I got this great degree from Cambridge University. I mean, that was just a big downer afterwards. Is this it? You know, all this which I was promised, all that hard work which I did to getting a big degree from a big university, so what? And you know, one of the reasons I became a monk, one of the reasons I never went further in academic career, is because you could see at universities like Cambridge where you socialized with the lecturers and with the professors and with the dons. And look, you know, some of those people had Nobel Prizes. I mean, these were sort of the top, the elite of academia. And you talk with them and just realize that these people hadn't got it together. Yeah, they were brilliant in their field, but they were stupid in life. You know that, I'm just rambling on here, but one of the people which we met here with Dennis, our president, Roger Penrose came into town some years ago. Now, he's Mr. Black Hole. He's the guy who discovered black holes. Sir Roger Penrose, one of the greatest physicists of our age, up there with Stephen Hawking. And he came, and Dennis, our president, sort of we went to have dinner with him. And, you know, because I'm well connected with the physicists over here. And I was actually, it's really amazing. All the other people there were sort of from NASA, they were professors of physics from all over the place. And I was the only sort of Buddhist monk. Well, anyone from religion, which actually shows just how Buddhism and even just, you know, the elite physics say we can actually melt together. But you looked at this person, which is so brilliant in his field, but you couldn't have a conversation with him. And do you remember this, Dennis? We were just all talking with each other, and even I was just chatting about all sorts of stuff with these people from NASA. And he was actually standing by himself, and no one was talking with him. And I was wondering that he's brilliant in front of the lecture theatre, apparently, and he's brilliant, you know, on a piece of paper, but he hasn't got his life together. And it was meeting people like that, I thought, that's not the meaning in life, becoming a great academic. It's not the meaning in life, becoming really rich people. Also at Cambridge, you know, one of the other people I knew was a real lord. He was an earl. That's really great, going around with a lord. I mean, a real lord, an earl. I don't know, was he an earl or a viscount? I forget what. But he was a pain in the butt. So what do you want to have these honours for if you don't just... is a hopeless person to be around. So, you know, for me, that I ticked off boxes early on in life. This was not where I was going to find my meaning in life. And it was actually good ticking off those boxes early. You know, it says fame, sort of, you know, being a great academic or being sort of... There was also these great sports people. Because the college I was at, Emmanuel, it's like at that time, it was like a sporting college. Many sort of top sports people went there. And one of the people I befriended over there was a guy called Majid Khan. He was an international cricketer, played for Pakistan. And now his thing is an international umpire. And, you know, you went to college with this guy. And even that time, you know, he was playing for Pakistan even though when he was in college. And again, even though he was an elite sportsman, he actually, you know, he was actually more had his act together. You know, he's a lot of fun to be with, but still there was something missing there. And then later on, as you become a monk, you get into all echelons of society as a monk. You know, doors are open to me which will be closed to all of you guys. I can go into autopsies and see bodies being cut up. You know, and it's really fascinating that. I really recommend it if, you know, you're looking for something to do over Christmas period. But you also actually go and meet these sort of, you know, the top-notch people, the very wealthy people. I think it was, I'm pretty sure that when I went to this dinner over in Canberra once, you know, I was going into the toilet, and I think it was, I didn't recognize him at the time, but I've seen pictures afterwards, Lachlan Murdoch. I wish I'd have taken a donation envelope with me for the Bangladesh orphanage. That's Rupert Murdoch's son. So you meet all these, you know, wealthy people and sort of presidents and stuff, but you think, is that really what life is all about? And it's not. There's something else there. So when you look for meaning in life, or when you put meaning in life, make sure that what you're really developing in your life is something which really does have meaning. And to me, just power, fame, wealth. I've ticked off those boxes a long time ago. That has no real meaning. It has no real satisfaction in the end for you. Now, to give you a story about that, there's so many stories about just the, what you might call the disillusionment which comes when you get wealth. There's so many stories about that. The story which I mentioned a few days ago, I think, I'm not quite sure where I said this and what I said, but somebody sent me an email about this couple in UK who won the lottery. They got instant money. Think about, was it 40 million British pounds? And so they bought this huge mansion, and 1 year later they sold that mansion. The reason they sold that mansion was they couldn't find their kids. It was just too big. And so there they were in this dream mansion, just what sometimes you would drool over, you see maybe in the TV, or you see in the magazines, or you may go past if you go driving down Peppermint Grove. You think, wow, wouldn't it be amazing to live in a huge place like that with manicured gardens, swimming pools, and with people to serve you, you know, whatever you needed. But then you think about what happens to a person in there. And this was someone who'd been there and done that. And because the house had so many rooms, they could never find their kids. Almost had to send a search party out to see which room they were in. And because of that, they realized that something was terribly, terribly missing in their life. Family, relationships, a bit of love. And I've seen that many times. Another time, this talking about big mansions, we went to a blessing ceremony, this big mansion in Shelley by the river, one of these very huge ones. And when I went in there to, was it a Thai or Chinese lady? I forget now. But anyway, we went in there to do the blessing ceremony for her new house. She just moved in. She wanted the monks to go in. That was a time when, you know, I'd just come all the way from Serpentine, from the monastery to Shelley. So one of the first things I did is say, can I use your toilet? And this is no joke. She had to draw me a map of how to get to the toilet in her house. It was ridiculous. But then afterwards, you know, when we were chatting together after doing the ceremony, I said, you know, how many people live here? She said, only me. And that wasn't funny. That really hurt me. Because, you know, you have empathy for people. You know, these are people you care about. And when she said, only me, you could see just the pain in that expression. There was a woman, filthy rich, staying in a huge mansion, all alone. And I asked her, why doesn't anyone else stay with you? And she said, I'm afraid of my family. I'm afraid they will ask me for some money, ask me for a loan. I'm afraid of any friends. I don't know if they're my friends because I'm rich and they want a loan or want to borrow some or want a gift or something. And because I don't trust anybody, not even my family, that is why I'm alone. And I thought that was a person who was imprisoned by their wealth. They weren't free at all. If I was them, I'd say, take that wealth and burn it. And have some freedom, because what has more meaning in life? Being free and just being able to enjoy your family and friends and have a great time together, or having that great wealth? So please, in your life, forget about the lottery tickets. You're not going to win anyway. And if you do, that's even worse. Now, forget about just getting the advancement in your work. Because, yes, so you get sort of the upgrade in your work and you get a bigger salary. But it means, you know, you have to work so much harder, so much longer, with more stress, and you don't see your family, your health goes down. Is that really what you want to do in life? And I'm very, very impressed with people who actually turn down the promotion. Say, no, this is enough for me. I want to be home at 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. to be with my kids. I want to have those holidays where I don't have to worry that you're going to SMS me to come back to the office because there's some important contract to fix up. Because at least they've got some understanding of the meaning of life, and they're putting that meaning into their life. I know many people talk about this, but it really is up to you to take hold of your life and not just be a victim. And just go along with life and just allow these things to happen to you. You do have that choice. As they say in Buddhism, you are the owner of your karma. It's a very powerful statement which we don't really say enough. You're the owner of your karma. In other words, you know, you have it in your hands. You have it in your hands to guide into your future and really do put meaning into your life. So yeah, I mean, you need to work. Now please have great jobs, but fulfilling jobs, and that doesn't mean your bank balance. It means when you go home at the end of the week, yeah, you've got enough money to pay the bills, but you feel you're actually doing something useful for the world as well. Because in those days which I had at university, it was fortunate that we did have time. We had time to reflect. And that's such an important thing in your life, to take that time out, not to do things, but just to stand back and just to reflect upon your life and which way it's going and how it's going and what is really important to you in life. Because we're coming to the end of this year, you know, December already. And it's a great time when things end. It does give you the opportunity to stop and reflect, because life goes on so fast. It's like a train which never stops, so you can't get out and just think, where the heck am I and which way am I going? This time of year is great for that. You have holidays. And so don't fill your holidays up with all these activities. Don't just think, I have to get this out of the way, I have to get that out of the way, all these jobs which have been building up for the year. If you just get jobs out of the way, you find that life gets out of the way. And that's one of the things which, you know, I've seen myself doing in a monastery, because I got lots of business, I got lots of responsibilities and work to do, lots of things to fix up and to settle and to do. But sometimes I catch myself, I say, I've got to get this out of the way and that out of the way and this out of the way and that out of the way, and then I meditate. And you find out you don't meditate at all, you don't stop. And so I decided, no, I'll get peace out of the way first of all. I get that done first of all, then I do all my other jobs. It reminds me of one of the old monk jokes. There are actually real Buddhist jokes. And this is the joke about, I may have told this a couple of weeks ago, I'm losing my mind, I don't mind. But if what I told last week, what I told this week, who cares anyway? But such a good joke. If you heard it before, it's a golden oldie about the monk who was called up at his monastery by someone. Can you please come round to do a blessing at my house? And the monk said, I'm sorry, I'm busy, I can't come. And the caller said, what are you doing, monk? He said, I'm doing nothing. That's what monks are supposed to do, nothing. And the caller understood, you appreciate, I mean, monks are supposed to be left the world and find peace and not just to be in the monastery doing things all day. I mean, that's the purpose of being a monk or a nun, to sit out there and just to contemplate life and to be still and to be peaceful and to let go of things and just to sit under a tree and just watch the trees grow. That's what we're supposed to be doing. So the man actually understood that and said, okay, very good, monk. So he rang the next day. He said, look, I really need you to do a blessing. Can you come to my house? He said, no, I'm busy. So that's what you said yesterday. What are you doing? I'm doing nothing, said the monk. But you said that's what you're doing yesterday. And the monk replied, yes, but I'm not finished yet. Now that's not just a funny joke, that has meaning to it, that has oomph behind it. So look, you know, somebody's sort of, your wife says, no, can you come and give me a hand? Say, darling, I'm busy. What are you doing? Nothing. How long is it going to take? I don't know, maybe sort of all my life. Maybe that's going too far, but isn't it really important actually to have this great opportunity when you do nothing? So you can actually stand back and just allow life to actually reflect itself on you. Just like only when the water is still can you actually stand over it and see your face clearly. Only when you stop rushing around doing things can you actually see what you're doing and see what the meaning of life truly is. That is why, you know, we have monasteries where you can go and stay. That's why we have retreat centers. You know, retreat centers are not so you can get enlightened. They're not so you can get jhanas. The retreat centers are there so you can stop. And you just do nothing and just see what's going on. Because everywhere else, you just, if you do stop, people say, what are you doing? Doing nothing. Oh, can you come and give me a hand then? They don't allow you to be peaceful. They don't allow you to be still. So these are places where you can be still. And it's in those stillnesses you find what the meaning of life is. And once you know what the meaning of life is, you can put it into your life. So when people get very depressed or they lose their way in life, please, you know, go to the monasteries which we have over here. They're great places where you can just come, sit. You don't even have to need to stay the night. Just go there and go in the meditation hall and just sit and do nothing. And don't ask for the meaning of life. Don't go seeking it. Just be still so you can know it. Because the point is, the meaning of life is not a theory. It's not some sort of view you can write in a book. That's why we don't like books in meditation monasteries. You know, it's not a Bible, it's not a Quran, as I told you many, many times. When people ask me, when you go to schools or universities, and they say the old question, yeah, in Christianity we have the Bible, in Judaism we have the Torah or the Kabbalah, in Islam we have the Quran. Sort of, what do you have in Buddhism? We have our heart. That's what we read. That's our holy book, right in here. In other words, you stop reading outside. If you have a book, it's just a mirror so you can experience what's inside. So it's the experience, especially in stillness. That's our holy book. That's why we don't argue so much. That's why Buddhism doesn't really have wars. I mean, real Buddhism, not organized Buddhism. Real Buddhism doesn't have wars. Because how can you have a war over what you read in your own heart? What's out there on a piece of paper, yeah, you can argue with. And you can get theologians who argue and try and work out what it all means. But experience, we know what experience is. So your meaning of life, what really has meaning for you in life? And straight away, you know, you find it's not the fame or the money or the other stuff. You know, the greatest meaning in life is when you've really served and helped someone. It's not just thinking compassion. It's actually succeeded in compassion. You've cared for someone and it's changed them. And I know that has been one of the greatest motivators of my life. You know, I learned that early on when I went to a Buddhist talk when I was still a student. And I heard all these great professors and monks give talks. And quite frankly, many times I went to sleep. Maybe it was that experience was why that I try to give interesting talks. And if I find you getting dull, that's when I tell the jokes to wake you up. Because I've been there, listening to very boring talks and just falling asleep myself. But I remember the one of the talks which I heard, which I would never forget, it didn't say very much about Buddhism at all, not as I expected. It didn't say about Four Noble Truths or Seven Enlightenment Factors and all this other stuff which you can read in books anyway. It was just this old English woman who was a Tibetan nun who was running an orphanage for very poor kids in Sikkim. And the way that she described her compassion was really inspiring. I realized from that time that Buddhism isn't a theory. Buddhism is actually what you do, how you behave. Just your kindness, your virtue, your peace, your forgiveness. That's what Buddhism is. It's not what you find in the books. What you find in the interaction between two very kind and caring people. I didn't realize at the time, but she taught Buddhism more eloquently than any professor or any monk at that time, which I knew. And so that's why the day after, I was so inspired. I went to my bank and took £10 out of my account. Now, this was in 1969. I was a very poor student. That was 2 weeks' food money for me. So I went hungry. I make up for it these days. But, you know, I was really hungry for that. I wasn't starving, but I didn't have as much as I would normally have, and it hurt. And because it hurt, I got so much happiness out of that, so much joy. I put £10 for this little orphanage and help kids. That was meaning. That was purpose. That was something which made life have a resonance and something very solid, which I could respect. It was a pointer to how I could find deeper meaning in my life. Because giving £10 to an orphanage, yeah, it helps them. It's important. But there's more you can do. It's great we have donations. And look, we've got somebody left this in here. We must be doing the Bangladesh orphanage appeal soon. We always do it at Christmas. Is that this week, Dennis? Or Bangladesh orphanage appeal. Look, if you give whatever to this orphanage, we've been looking after this for a long time. It just makes you so happy when you get the pictures and see that these are kids, boys and girls, you know, who've got absolutely no parents, and in Bangladesh, of all countries, one of the poorest countries in the world. And they don't get government support. And actually this particular orphanage, I think it's something like 95% funded by you guys. So this is why this is the one which the Buddhist Society, we look after. But you do that, and you help someone, and you go and see them afterwards, and you get teary. For those of you who've been here a long time, when we had the tsunami, that we raised funds over here, and when we raised the funds, we didn't know really exactly what organization to give them to. But the other organisation I'm associated with in Singapore, the Buddhist Fellowship, they were also raising funds. And the Singapore Red Cross, they had this deal that if you would put sort of had any amount of money for the tsunami appeal in one of the countries there, they would match it 4-1. So our Buddhist society, we're very clever. We sent our donation over to Singapore to our Buddhist Fellowship. We donated it to them. We joined in with them. And so for every dollar we collected here, we got another $4 from the Red Cross. So I don't know how, we had, it was a couple of million or something, we got. And so we looked after this orphanage. I think it was in Khao Lak in Thailand, I think. Oh no, they also did one building homes in Sri Lanka as well. We did the two in Sri Lanka. I forget the name of the village we looked after, but also in an orphanage. And it's twice I've been to that orphanage. And when you just see that just people's donations, and you see little kids, these sweet little kids, you know, without mother or father, they have each other. And see this huge family, but now 30 or 40, everyone from different parents, but just behaving like brothers and sisters and having a whale of a time and doing a sort of a Thai dance, which was not properly done. I mean, not like any professionals at all. It's kids, you know, trying to do their very best. But it makes you cry. It's just so sweet and beautiful that you've given them happiness. You've given them a life. You've given them a future. So when I do that, I mean, people say, oh, you must be tired. You're teaching a retreat at the same time. You're traveling. What do you mean tired? That's where you get your energy from. That's where you get your passion. That's where you get your inspiration from. So every time you do something like that, you found meaning. And it's because of that that I've been telling people for a long time now, if any of you are under clinical depression, or, you know, if it's through extreme depression, go and, you know, get some pills. But just ordinary depression, or you're a bit fed up, or, you know, life isn't going well, or like someone told me today, England aren't doing so well in the Ashes. And what was the other thing, that Australia's not doing so well in the Ashes or something. Someone's not doing so well in the Ashes. Someone's always depressed in sport. And I think, was it Australia never got the World Cup or whatever. So look, instead of getting depressed, because life is like that at times, for those of you who are really, really down, just go and do some charity work. Just get off your bums and go to an old people's home, to a hospital, or somewhere, and just serve. Because it's a great thing to be able to serve. Because what it actually does, not only does it teach you about what life is all about, but it gives you this great sense of worth. You're actually helping someone. Again, just when I was at university, now I was the only Buddhist I knew at that college. So it was very lonely. So you had your friends and you had great sort of philosophical arguments. And this one guy who was a very close friend, you know, he was a Christian. And so we had these great discussions. It wasn't sort of antagonistic, but it was animated. And when I heard he was going to the local mental hospital to do voluntary work, I thought, I'd better go along as well. I'm a Buddhist. I'm supposed to be compassionate. And even though, you know, you're very busy and all this other stuff you're supposed to do at university, no, I went. And I enjoyed it so much that I kept going for 2 years. Those Christians, actually, they just dropped out. And I went for 2 years. And sometimes, you know, what are you trying to prove? They asked me. And I think about it. Actually, it went way beyond doing service. I wasn't there to do service. I was actually getting joy out of this. It gave my week meaning. Just to go and hang out with Down syndrome's kids. And that's really all I was doing. I wasn't an expert. I wasn't trying to do anything much with them except just be with them. And to this day, I credit that with teaching me what I call like emotional language. So, you know, if I'm a good teacher for you, it's not just the way you speak. Anyone can say words. It's where they come from. Because these were kids who just can't speak in the same way. At least these kids who are institutionalized couldn't speak in the same way as I speak to you if you come and ask me a question or we just talk about whatever. They didn't have the vocabulary or the the way to articulate their thoughts, but they communicated through their emotions, through their hugs, through their facial language. And my goodness, they were just so clever. I remember many times just going there, and they sussed me out straight away. If I was in a bad mood, they'd know what's wrong, and they'd give me a hug. You know, it was the first time as a man I'd allowed another man to hug me. I was a heterosexual. I was afraid of sort of homosexuality, because that's just the way I was conditioned. And there you had to allow, as a male, a young male in 1969 or 70, allow another male to hug you. And that was tough. You know, English, stiff upper lip and all that. That was tough, but it was so wonderful for me to learn just how to be loved. I got so much from those kids. I really sort of thanked them so much. So I thought I was giving when I first went there. But no, I got heaps and heaps. And I've got enormous gratitude for what I learned when I gave. And that's where you start to understand what meaning is. I know I do traveling around a lot. After teaching here, okay, on Sunday, I travel to Bangkok. And I just give this whole series of talks all day. You teach like retreats and like a meditation workshop. And then you have an hour probably for a shower. And then you have another talk in the evening. And look, if you looked at that schedule, if I was a member of the union, Kevin Reynolds or whatever, he would actually say, no, you're exploiting Ajahn Brahm. You can't do this. It's too much work. Now, no member of any union would work as hard as I do. But is it exploitation? No, please give me more. I keep on saying to them, why? It's because you get so much energy and joy out of this, because I am serving and I am being with people. I'm getting my meaning in life. So I really thank you for coming here and letting me get high off giving a talk to you. Now you can understand, well, you put this meaning in life, and it's amazing just when you don't ask anything back in return, but you sort of give care, you give just your energy, non-judgmental, it's amazing just how much meaning you find in just the ordinary things in life of just being with someone, caring for them, being with them, and just learning and growing from each other. And there's never, ever any idea of superiority, because it's never about me being better than you or you being better than me. As I keep on saying, the secret of any relationship, even if it's just talking with somebody on the bus, it's never me, it's never them, it's always us. I'm just trying to remember that. So it's not me talking down to a person or talking up to them. It's never about me or you. It's always about we, us. It's the whole, not the parts. And that changes the whole way we look at, you know, our interactions. It's not an interaction, as Thich Nhat Hanh said, it's an interbeing which we have with each other. And there you can find a great amount of meaning. One of the reasons you have that extra amount of meaning, because in those interactions, when you disappear and the other person disappears anymore, it's never self. It's never about me. That terrible, terrible idea in life about ego, me and mine, which unfortunately we learn when we're very young at school. That's where we usually start gaining our personal identity and thinking, you know, that we're actually separate from other beings. We get our name. I remember I got my peg at the schoolyard where I had to hang my raincoat and had a little name underneath it. And I realized that I had to put my name on the books, you know, and I developed my identity, the thing which separated me from other beings. You know, I was told to go to the male's toilets, not the female. They had the male playground, the female playground in the primary school. So that separation gave me identities. And you know how separation causes all the problems in this life. I'm not saying that the men should go into the female toilets tonight. That would give you a lot of trouble if the girls go to men's toilets. But what I'm actually saying over there is, you know, the separation into sort of, you're a Buddhist, you're a Catholic, you know, you're a Muslim, you're this, you're a boy, you're old, you're English, you're Australian, you're whatever. That's where the suffering of the Ashes cricket test comes from. That's where the suffering of who gets a World Cup Could we separate ourselves out into this nation and that nation, this religion, that religion, this race, that race? It's not that Australia lost the World Cup. It's that the world gained the World Cup. That the world won the Ashes cricket. We won it, not someone. And that way, isn't there something very, very beautiful? Instead of competition, there is this beautiful sense of cooperation in this world, of being with people rather than being against people. And there you actually see the sense of ego and separation of spirits. And now you're actually understanding what the meaning of life is. So in the meaning of life, if you want to put meaning of life is, take yourself out, number one. It's not about you anymore. Take the other person out as well. It's not about them. I know that many people misunderstand compassion in Buddhism. They think compassion in Buddhism, thinking about everybody else, which means you get burnt out, people use you as a rug, a doormat or whatever, and you get abused. You don't count because you're sort of always this self-effacing person in the sense that, you know, you're thinking about everybody else. After a while you get burnt out, you get depressed, and you get a real mess. That is not compassion, about just sacrificing yourself for other people. Compassion is looking at yourself no more, no less, looking at the whole, everybody. It's all about us. You disappear. The other person disappears. It's about community, family, the whole race, the whole beings, all sentient beings, the whole earth looked upon as one organism with many different parts, like the ant's nest, all working together, never thinking of yourself as an individual or the other. It's amazing, the ant's nest, just how intelligent they are. Years and years ago, at our monastery in Serpentine, where there are many ant's nests, there was this one visitor. He decided to give the ants an intelligence test. Because, you know, the ant's nest, he put a sugar cube on top of the ant's nest. And I wondered, the ants love this sugar, but it's like one of these hard cubes. I wonder what they would do with this. Would they break it up to take it into the small holes, to take it into the center of their nest, or what would they do? And he really couldn't believe their intelligence, their engineering prowess. What these ants did, they excavated under the sugar cube. So day by day, the sugar cube got lower and lower and lower and lower. And when it got, the top got below the surface, it put the earth on top again. Now, exactly the same way, I think, the Viet Cong buried the American tanks during the Vietnam War, how they actually drew them underground. And there was just a community of ants who'd never seen a sugar cube before, ever. Incredible intelligence when we can work together. Isn't it terrible that we work against each other so often, especially in our companies, in our businesses, in our religions? We work against each other, we never get anywhere. You work together, there's no end of successes. So meaning in life, giving you success, is learning to work not as me working with you, but always about us. Change the whole mindset. That's one of the reasons why in Buddhism we stress sort of non-self. We stress compassion. The two go together. This is not a theory. It's actually the way we experience life, a different framework for looking. Which is why that when you do service, that's where you find meaning, because you disappear, you vanish. But if you ever do any service and you think, I'm doing this for my merit, for my good karma, you won't get very much out of that. Because it's, again, personal. It's just what we call, what this monk calls spiritual materialism. It's a great word, because once you have the word, you can see so many things which you can actually put under that umbrella of spiritual materialism. You can see you doing that sometimes. I don't know how many people go onto a retreat and they're really trying so hard to get nimittas, these beautiful lights in the mind, or they're trying to get jhanas. Spiritual materialist again. You're trying to get something. That's one of the reasons why, if you ever go on a retreat led by me, I'll repeat something which Ajahn Chah, who was a great teacher, said, you meditate not to get things, but to let things go. Not to get, but to lose things. which is one of the reasons why I said at our monastery, I think today, I said, monks and nuns, we are the biggest losers. We've lost everything. I've lost my degree. I've lost any possibility of having a wife and kids. I've lost sex. I've lost movies. I've lost everything. But you see if you can lose a bit more, because you can always lose a bit more. And you can see what means is you're letting go more. You're detaching more. And so it's really incredible that we talk of biggest loser being like something very negative. And if you call someone a loser, that's one of the worst things you can call a person in our modern society. But if someone calls me a loser, you say, yeah, you've got it. Thank you for that wonderful accolade and piece of praise. I'm really trying more to lose more things. So thank you for calling me a loser. That's in monastic terms, that's actually a compliment. So if anyone on the street calls you a loser, it means your spiritual practice is going very well. You know, it gives you a lot of meaning in life to be free. Have you ever felt freedom? I don't mean thinking freedom, because you can actually read philosophical books about freedom and the different ideas about freedom. But have you ever felt free? What does it feel like? Where did you feel like that? You know, one of the first times I felt free, going back to my experience of childhood, I had this afternoon off school. And at lunchtime, I did all my homework. And so as I walked out those school gates, I had actually nothing to do. I had nowhere to go. I had no appointments, no business which I needed to complete. I remember that afternoon, even now. I was about 13 or 14 at the time. It was my first experience of freedom. I could do whatever I wanted, go wherever I wanted, with no constraints at all. No force, no compulsion, totally free. It's a beautiful feeling. Can you ever feel like that? You don't have to achieve anything. You don't have to fulfill any duties, complete any projects. You can just be. That told me what freedom was. At least it gave me a taste of freedom. That word, a taste of freedom, you know that's an important Buddhist word. Even actually, I think Ajahn Chah's first book, we gave it that title, The Taste of Freedom. Because it's actually term by the Buddha, vimutti rasa in Pali. Because I know I give these talks, sometimes I have to quote Pali just to say, look, I know my stuff. You know, this is actually, you know, from the suttas. I'm not just a monk who just speaks from his own ideas. This is all based on the Buddha's teachings. So the taste of freedom, what actually is that? If you understand the taste of freedom, you understand a deeper meaning in life. Where all of this craving and wanting and ill will, all this stuff which agitates the mind and stops you being, which is always making you do things and go places and fix things and mend things and all that stuff, after a while that just drives you crazy. Whenever will there be an end of all this having to fix up things? You know, that was one of the reasons why, another little anecdote. When the former abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery, Ajahn Chacko, who's a great monk, when he disrobed and I was left looking after the monastery, I would work very hard because, you know, I had all my ideas I would like to do for that monastery. I worked very hard. So from Monday to Friday, I'd work like a dog at that monastery, building and looking after the place and being abbot at the same time. Many of those buildings there, you know, I did, built myself, laying the bricks, and you know, Dennis knows that, he's seen me down there, he's our president. And on a weekend, I'd come here, Friday, just give the talk, Saturday, Sunday, just counsel people, talk with people, do ceremonies. So go back late Sunday evening, Monday morning back to work again. It was 7 days a week. And because of that, sort of, you know, I could never enjoy that monastery. So much so, I thought, when people came, you know, you come sort of to visit the monastery to Bing Dan, you're all relaxed. because you relax, this is your day off. And you come to the monastery to feed the monks or to feed the nuns and have a peaceful time. Maybe you go in the meditation hall, do a bit of meditation, have a walk around to relax. And I got jealous of you. And so you come to that monastery and you're relaxed and I've got all these jobs to do. I've got to talk to you. I've got to sort of fix things up. And I realized that there's something wrong with my life. My life was always getting things done and doing things. So I remember just seeing that, having enough space just to look back and see the mistakes I was making in my life. I made this resolution every Monday morning when that was the Sunday, Saturday, Sunday, just working here. Monday morning, I'd go back to that monastery and that would be a doing nothing morning. And I'd walk around that monastery not looking for the things which needed to be fixed up. Not looking for the letters which needed to be written. Not looking for the telephone calls which I had to make. No, this was not my work time. So I wanted to see that monastery with the same eyes that a visitor on holiday could see that monastery. And that was a hard thing to do, but you know, you learn how to do that. Because when you go there, you can't see all the things which need to be done. It's not your monastery. So I did that and found, wow, that's how I can be free. Not with the fault-finding mind, but the opposite, a mind of compassion, which can accept things as they are and see the value in things as they are. To realize not everything, every moment, needs to be fixed up. It does not need to be changed. You don't need to make it better. You don't need to sort of push it forward. Leave it as it is, for goodness sake. And at first that was a tough thing to do, to leave things as they are, because you think that's being lazy. Our society, it creates depression and anxiety because we don't allow people to be lazy. I want to create a lazy people's society. So lazy people's rights. So you have right to be lazy, at least you know, one day of a week or one morning of a week. So you can actually sit there and actually do nothing and have permission to do nothing. If you really want to, I'll give you a certificate. Ajahn Brahm hereby gives you permission to do nothing one morning a week. And you can show it to your partner. Okay, I've got permission. Okay, so I can. Because if you don't do that, you're not enjoying anything in life. I could not enjoy the place which I lived because there was always a workplace for me. I couldn't even enjoy my body because I always had to wash it, take it to the toilet, do something with it. I could never enjoy my life because it was always something to improve. You're missing out on the meaning of life when you're so active in doing things, making things better. So I left it alone. You know what I found on those Monday mornings? That monastery was beautiful. Why did I keep wanting to change it? Yeah, it's all right to do some duties and work, but not every moment of your life, for goodness sake. Please stop. And when you stop, you realized that life was much more beautiful than you ever thought. Please stop, and you'll find your partner is not as bad as you thought they were. You stop, and you find out, my God, you're beautiful as well. I realized the great insight, I am good enough. It's a beautiful thing to understand, to realize I am good enough. I don't need to change and be perfect. I am good enough. If you want something to write on a piece of paper and put by your bed so you can see it every night before you go to sleep and every morning the first thing you look at when you wake up, I am good enough. Because people have been telling me all my life I'm not good enough. Even though I got good marks at university, come on, you can go higher. You can work harder. You're a genius, but you can be a super genius. Come on, you can do better. You give a good talk, you can give a better talk. You get meditation, but you can do better meditation. You can levitate, but not high enough. Gee, where is the end to all of this? So it's a great, wonderful thing to realize, I am good enough. I don't need to make things better anymore. I can actually have a taste of freedom. And my goodness, it tastes delicious. To realize you don't have to change anything, be anything, do anything. I'm good enough. And the amazing thing is, once you see that you're good enough, you notice how many other people are also good enough. Which means you can love others. Are you in love with someone? If you want to change them, you're not really in love with them. If you're trying to make them better, fix up their faults, all those irritating things in life which can really upset you, your love hasn't made the grade. If you look at your partner and say, and you really mean it, you're good enough to love and be my partner. What a wonderful thing that is. Your partner realizes they don't have to change for you. They're good enough. You look at yourself, I don't need to change either. This is me, this is who I am. I'm at peace with myself. Peace coming from freedom. That's, to me, one of the deepest meanings of life. I know people always want to find peace of mind. Where the heck can you find peace of mind? Do you have to make yourself perfect before you have peace of mind? Do you have to go through therapy courses for the rest of your life before you can get your act together? Do you have to be wealthy, rich, beautiful, have Botox treatments? Do you have to sort of lose all your weight before you can be perfect enough? No, I'm good enough. It is beautiful having the feeling that you're good enough. Because then you find the taste of freedom. It's the freedom from this being told you have to do this, you have to go there, you have to be something different than you really are. You know how much suffering that is? Thinking that you're not good enough and you have to change and be different. That's your life, isn't it? Being told by so many people you're not good enough. And you come here and you're told you should meditate deeper, get jhanas. Ajahn Brahm says you must get jhanas. I'm not good enough, I haven't got jhanas yet. No, please. You're good enough. And I'm very proud and happy and honored that you're here this evening and you're members of our Buddhist society. So you are all good enough. I'll give you that certificate, good enough certificate. If you don't believe it, I'll sign one for you. So you get this wonderful taste of freedom. How many other places can you actually feel free? How many other places do you think that someone's judging you, they're sort of criticizing you, trying to sort of make you different? At work, always having to work harder. You know, in home, please in a home, love each other. And don't always try and sort of make each other different. The rest of the world makes you do that. Not at home, please. Let that be like your holy place, your shrine, your sacred area. A home should be like a temple of love where people are accepted and not criticized. So if you can actually do that, you're understanding what the taste of freedom is. And then you do find these moments, deep moments of peace of mind. Just like that afternoon I had free from school. Total peace. Nothing was missing. I didn't need to do anything. Didn't need to fix anything up. That's why I remember that. The first time I probably knew peace of mind. Sitting there just being at peace. Not needing to get anywhere or do anything. And please, when you meditate, that's how you meditate too. These days, that's where I found the deepest meaning of my life. You meditate there, you're sitting in my cave where I live, or you're sitting sort of in your room somewhere, and you're not thinking, what talk am I going to give this evening? I'm not sort of thinking just what have I got to pack for going to Thailand on Sunday? I'm not thinking of what talk I'm going to give when I get there. I'm not talking about, you know, how can I fix all the problems in Buddhist society or wherever. I don't think like that. It'll sort itself out. You know, a lot of times when you're totally irresponsible, life goes on much better. But when you actually get involved in trying to fix things up, it gets worse. Have you ever noticed that in life? I've noticed that too many times. It's better I get out of the way. I'm not indispensable. In fact, the more you dispense of me, the better. In other words, get out of the way and just let things roll on. It's nature. Life is like that. So when I sort of just leave things alone, you get this beautiful sense of peace. I know how to meditate because that's the biggest skill which I developed over these years. I never meditate but like this. Never, please don't try to be something or get somewhere. Don't put forth this terrible effort Where does that effort come from? What are you trying to achieve anyway? I want to be peaceful. Come on, be peaceful. Be peaceful. Be peaceful. I just exaggerate there just to show what you're doing when you meditate, which is why people don't get peaceful in meditation. How do you become peaceful? You just put things down, leave them alone. Stop disturbing the process. So you get out of the way and you don't do anything. Just leave things alone. Be kind to this moment. Allow this moment to be. So you're not trying to get anywhere, do anything. You're not striving or struggling. Trying to make your mind different than it is. If you've got a stupid mind and it's all over the place or it's tired, leave it alone. It's none of your business. Just like my monastery, on the Monday morning, it's not my business. I just look at it as if I'm a visitor. I don't try and change it. Because I didn't try and change that, I notice its beauty. Just like you notice its beauty when you visit there. So when in my mind I stop trying to change it, I'm not the abbot of my mind. I'm not the manager, the controller, the boss. So when I visit it, I see it as beautiful as you see the beautiful monasteries in which our monks and nuns live. Your mind is already beautiful. What are you trying to change it for? So change your attitude instead. Make peace with your mind. Exactly as it is. And just like me, I found my monastery was just so beautiful. I found peace of mind. Not by trying to get peace of mind, but stopping the getting, stopping the wanting. I realized peace of mind was there all the time. Then I was just looking somewhere else. I was trying to find peace of mind over here, over there, anywhere. But instead of just in this moment with my mind as it was. That is the most powerful meaning of life. Stillness, inner peace, realizing there's nothing to get, nowhere to go. The end of craving, the end of wanting, and realizes it's there for you all the time, you're just looking in the wrong place. You're looking and trying to achieve things, rather than just letting go of all that wanting to achieve. That's real meaning of life. So whatever I do in my busy, busy life, all of the struggles, which, you know, I have struggles as well. You know, I do a lot of work trying to push this Buddhist society forward and also other societies which I get involved in. I'm a very stupid monk. People ask me to do things and I usually say yes. I get into big trouble all the time. But that's part of my life. You're trying to push Buddhism, the world, life forward, whether it's ordaining bhikkhunis or supporting voluntary euthanasia or all these other stuff which I put out there and sometimes you get criticized for. But in the end, I just always just go into my meditation and just, okay, my work is done. I've done what I thought was right. Now's the time just to stop. In stopping, you find the deepest meaning of life. Not just doing things, not trying to find meaning, but stopping and being the meaning you were searching for. Try it. That's why the Buddhism was such a successful path over this many years. Not because it went in the path of trying to achieve things, because it knew how to stop all this craving and wanting business. And every time you do that, you'll find out what the monks and nuns experience. When you stop all this wanting, you stop all this searching, you stop all this spiritual materialism, you find the deepest meaning of life. Stillness, peace of mind, nirvana. You don't get nirvana by running after it. You get it through stopping. I'll finish with one of my favorite similes, which I usually only talk about at retreats, but it works here this evening. It's a nice little story just to finish with. It's a story, one of my favorite stories of the donkey and the carrot. Those of you who know this story because you've been on the retreats, it's also in the book of Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. You know that donkeys are very stubborn animals. That's why they say in English, as stubborn as a donkey. You hit them with the stick, they won't move. So the only way you get donkeys to move is you tie the stick to their back. So the front of the stick is about 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. At the end of the stick you put a string, on the end of the string a carrot. So there's this donkey seeing this carrot 2 foot in front of it. Craving is what drives the donkey, not fear of punishment. So there the donkey moves forward to try and get the carrot. But because the carrot is on the end of a stick and the stick is tied to the donkey, doesn't matter how fast the donkey goes forward, the carrot goes at the same speed. So it's always 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. But he's stupid enough to think, well, if I run a bit faster, I might catch that carrot. Do you understand the simile? That's called your life. Chasing a carrot. Do you ever get it? Now, it's always 2 foot in front. You almost get it sometimes, you know, just perfection, you know, happiness, you know, even deep meditation. It's almost there, and you just go a bit forward, and it goes more further away from you. But many donkeys have actually heard my talks on YouTube. And they now know how to catch the carrot. How to find meaning in life. You know how you do that? The donkey's already been running really fast. And the donkey hears the word, stop. Stop chasing that carrot. Stop. So the donkey stops. You know what happens when you stop? The carrot moves further away than it's ever been before. But you've got patience and trust and faith. You've heard Ajahn Brahm, you actually believe you may be onto something. So you stop. And soon it's 4 foot away from you. Twice as far as it's ever been. And you get to a bit of doubt. You know, is this going to happen? Is it true? But then something amazing happens. The carrot starts coming towards you. And soon it's in its normal position, 2 foot in front of your mouth. But now it's coming at great speed. Towards you. You don't have to do anything. You just sit there. And just at the right moment, you remember the most important phrase, the door of my mouth is now open to you, carrot. And the carrot gets into your own mouth. That's how you find meaning in life. You stop. The meaning just goes further away from you at first, but be patient. And then it comes towards you. You don't chase it. You stop. At the right moment, a bit of compassion. Thank you. That's how you become enlightened. Thank you for listening. So any questions or comments about putting meaning into life and finding meaning in life? Any questions? Going? Okay, gone. I think you've enough information for the night.